This is on. Okay. So the topic that we're going to cover in these 2 weeks, personally I find, is relatively less discussed, less published, less understood. And so because of that, often some of the predictions made about drug resistance and all published, they didn't pan through in the real pandemic or real disease processes, and we are still understanding. So this is an attempt to bring together where we are at and what is missing. And so I saw in the program lots of talks and very interesting talks, and even the previous 2 weeks I thought were very, very good talks. But they're talking the drug resistance in the population, and the center of all these things is what is happening mechanistically in vivo in a person. And these 2 weeks is essentially to focus on that, and my intention will be to, I look forward to bringing that closer so that you develop or you think of models which start from the mechanism and in an individual, and individuals also vary, you know, immunocompromised, incompetent, and you know, babies and older. So, and you see how it manifests in the population. So what I didn't see in the program was how drug resistance develops in any way. So I thought, I just took upon myself, and I thought I'll organize that a little bit, very short, introductory. But at the same time, we got to relate to this process to the immune response that is happening. The immune response is totally married to this. So models which are incorporating this will have a good chance of making some reasonable predictions. With that said, so Bhargavi and I will be basically talking mechanisms of drug resistance and immune response. Just to prime you with where we are going, with what's happening. So here are a whole bunch of infectious human pathogens that you may have heard of. I kind of put them into some categories, and the category will be are viruses, bacteria, parasites, and of course prions. You may have heard of causing CJD disease in humans. And in viruses, again, the idea is to provide you an infectious process. By definition, is the one where there is a replication of a unwanted entity. So the basis of replication in viruses can be based upon a DNA genome or RNA genome. Bacteria always DNA genome, parasites DNA genome. Prions, some 15, 20 years ago, when they were realized, there was a major resistance because there is no nucleic acid base. So how they're replicating, and so basically, it is a case of, you may know, protein misfolding, and once so a misfolded protein imprints its effect on the correctly folded proteins and forces them to misfold. So in other words, it spreads its effect on many molecules. So it is not the number of organisms multiplying, it is the number of molecules erroneous or pathogenic molecules spreading. So here I have listed some of the pathogens, you know, smallpox, of course, you don't hear of that. So these are herpes viruses, these four, you know, alpha herpes viruses, chickenpox, HSV-1 and 2, EBV, CMV, hepatitis B virus, and HPV. I had electron micrographs of them. I don't know where I lost in the conversion. But then, of course, RNA genome containing viruses, influenza, SARS-CoV, hepatitis C, polio, measles. And again, another class of RNA viruses are retroviruses with HIV, HDV1, 2. This is not the complete list, but this is just to give you, just to prime you with an example of things. And then, of course, a whole lot of pathogens, bacterial pathogens. This is causing whooping cough, tuberculosis, anthrax, chlamydia, you know, these are STDs and gonorrhea and MRSA. This is a very, very common nosocomial infection that is in the hospitals. Leprosy, E. coli, C. difficile. And then, of course, the parasitic infections. I just chose some because the drug resistance are related to these, okay? So malaria, leishmania, and schistosomiasis, and of course this. Now what I'm going to show you, these are, in many of the cases, there is a resistance. And so viruses, I just give incidents or examples. So in case of viruses, there's a very frequent resistance found to HIV, much, much more frequent than influenza viruses, and which is also much, much more frequent than hepatitis B and C. Herpes viruses we find, pox viruses also we find, many viruses, but the incidence, the frequencies are lower and lower and lower. You don't hear too much of acyclovir-resistant HSV-1. It happens, but it's extremely rare. HIV is so rampant. And you will see what is the basis of all that. So this is relevant. Also, in bacteria, there's a multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, much more frequent. MRSA is mostly in hospitals, and some in community, C. difficile, and bacterial STDs, leprosy, very, very few cases. But the cases are not so many. But the mechanisms are shared. And in case of parasites, drug resistant malaria, fungal diseases, leishmania, and many of you may not know, even there is a drug resistant prions. This is experimentally observed by none other than Stanley Prusiner. Stanley Prusiner is the one who discovered prions and got Nobel Prize for that. And just last year he published a very nice paper showing that this quinacrine is a drug that can shut off prion disease. And it is not clinically used yet because when you use this drug, the drug has to cross blood-brain barrier, and it is not able to. So they created a mouse, a genetic variant, where this drug, where the protein responsible for blocking the entry of this drug into the through the blood-brain barrier was removed. Consequently, they were able to show the effect of this drug on the mouse with prion disease. That yes, mouse was able to be cured, but for 60-70 days, this disease disappeared and everything. 20 days later, 90 days, it reappeared, and it was drug resistant. And so there's a very nice basis of that too. So in other words, this is a very universal common phenomena of finding resistance to pathogens, drug resistance in pathogens. And here, of course, there are some examples of HIV resistant to what. And of course, we'll go into detail in some other sessions. So, and this is not a problem in a country where there is a, you know, undernourishment too many diseases. Yes, actually, developing countries have as much problem as underdeveloped countries. So here's an example, drug resistance, tuberculosis in Canada. Look at this. Everywhere there's a resistance. Almost everywhere, I should say. These areas are not. But in vast part of Canada, there is a resistance. And in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec and all, you also have multi-drug resistant TB. Some attribute this to importation, migration of people here, immigration, but it's also local, quite a bit of drug resistance. But the problem is much more rampant in other developing countries. And if you have any questions, just pop up in between, there's no problem. So how does drug resistance develop, after all? And this is what I want you to get some idea. So here are the three fundamental requirements of drug resistance. A pathogen must replicate, and then second requirement is there must be introduction of mutations through, usually the that happens through error proneness of the polymerase that replicates the pathogen. The second, it could be through, these mutations can also be introduced through recombination or reassortment events. In case of influenza virus, there's a reassortment. In case of bacteria, there's a tremendous recombination. And so number of single point mutants formed, we're talking with this, is the rate of replication divided by rate of mutation. So basically, this is quite calculatable, and you are all naturally primed individuals, and so you can take it to a very fine analysis, mathematical analysis, that what is the outcome of these important, unavoidable biological processes. Remember, this mutations in any polymerase I'm talking right from viruses all the way to human, in the whole process, when any polymerase replicates the genome, there is an implicit degree of error. Through the course of evolution, bacteria onwards, not in viruses, bacteria onwards, there is a proofreader attached. And that proofreader actually corrects the mistake, but not all of them. Even in humans, you have about roughly one base pair error in 10 million base pairs replicated. If that didn't happen, and thank God it happened, we will stop evolving. So there's a very fine balance between reducing the number of errors and keeping the integrity of the species, at the same time having enough room for evolution. So, and then of course, the third very important component of that there has to be a selection pressure, and which is through antimicrobial drugs, immune response to pathogen, infection control, and you can have some more too. So this is the broad three fundamental rules. Models need to incorporate this one way or the other. And you will see where we begin to bring immune system. Immune system has a major impact on this process. Okay? Immune system can't affect this. So understanding the dynamics of the immune response and immune system is very, very critical. And of course, then you have other pressures. Selection, basically, this is very simply shown. Because, as I told you, that immune system has nothing to do with the mutation formation. It's the property of the polymerase that makes the errors. So even in the absence of any selection pressure, any drug, all kinds of mutations do occur, and this is shown here. So for example, this is a drug-sensitive pathogen. Before selection, all sorts of variants of this pathogen exist. Some are more resistant to drug than the others. You can see the degree here, for example. Then after selection, everybody is gone except those which are resistant, and of course they amplify. This is selection process, simple as that. How mathematically you express this, this will be up to you. And now, but there are these factors which regulate the resistance development. So there are quite a few of them, which are internal to an individual, which happens in an individual, and there are some which happens in the population. In an individual, there are genetic factors like error proneness of enzyme, which discuss degeneracy of genetic code. I'll talk to you in a minute, and some recombinant events. Then factors selecting or rejecting the mutation. So mutation happens, but that doesn't mean it's going to be mattering. In fact, many a times it doesn't matter because the pathogen is extinct. Some areas of mutation cannot be tolerated, or it has no impact on the replication rate or the virus fitness. And then, of course, it is also rejected by some or nullified by some compensatory mutation or recombination events. So as a result, the effect of mutation is muted. And of course, immunologic factors, which I plan to Bhargavi will talk some, but I'll plan to cover in some other talk I have next Friday, go into more detail. How immune system matters. How immune response matters. And believe me, it does matter a lot. And of course, the pharmacologic drugs, you have antivirals and you have antibiotics, And the demographics, this is a population, how it contributes to drug resistance problem. Genetic background of people may matter, age distribution, immunodemography, people are immunocompromised or immunocompetent, and how interconnected hosts are people are, okay? So many a times in models, these factors, some or more than one, actually many sometimes need to be represented. So here is a fundamental process, which is mutation, as I told, mutation and recombination. So this is a very simple demonstration of a sequence, a pathogen genetic sequence, and a polymerase without proofreader. No, polymerase has a separate entity, proofreader, separate. So this polymerase, that it, when it replicates this genome, makes too many errors. And these errors are corrected by proofreader, which is an exonuclease. Those of you who have studied biology and biochemistry will probably know this. And this proofreader corrects these mistakes, but not all of them, as I mentioned before. It actually leaves some. And but this mutation is not, each mutation is not necessarily connected with a change in the amino acid in the protein. Essentially, what matters is change in the amino acid in the protein. So as you know, there's a degeneracy of genetic code. There are many a times, for example, if the third base is changed here, any one of the four, it will still code for serine. So this and serine has six codons. So you have lots of room for mutation to happen, yet amino acid will not change. Such changes in or such mutations are called symmetric mutations, where amino acids are not changed. But in cases where amino acids are changed, they are called non-symmetric mutations. And actually, so once the mutation has happened, there are four potential consequences, outcome. One is that if you follow over time, the genetic and phenotypic characteristics of the pathogen, you'll find that if you do the that if DN over DS, this ratio is greater than one, it means the pathogen likes that mutation and pathogen prefers to have this, called positive selection. And in other cases, if the ratio is one, it didn't make a difference either way. But if it is reduced, it's less than one, then it's negative, so the pathogen doesn't like it. It can't multiply very well. And of course, if it is zero, that is, pathogen becomes extinct because the pathogen can't tolerate that mutation. So this is, in fact, many a times, the mutation leads to extinction of the pathogen. It's a large factor, okay? And here, I bring a case of HIV. HIV, its genetic variation is much greater than other lentiviruses. Howard Temin, the person who discovered retroviruses, Howard Temin and David Baltimore, he actually measured in the lab that that the error rate of HIV reverse transcriptase is in this range. However, in vivo he found it's 20 times less error prone, but 3 to 7 times is still greater than other retroviruses, and most transitions are from G to A. And of course, if you incorporate this in any simple conclusion, assuming that 10 billion HIV particles are replicated per day in a newly infected patient. You'll see that viruses with a single point mutations can be generated. 28,000 some copies viruses are generated per day, at every point, at any specific locus. In other words, every possible mutation you can find in these patients. Okay, and but those with concurrent two specific loci, if you calculate, will be about 3 per day. But if you see three or more will be actually three will be I mean, it will take 10,000 days to get three mutants. These calculations will be very useful when you're following drug resistance and immune escape. So this is an example I gave. Here is, of course, in case of hepatitis C, every day, in a patient, at every location, at least one mutant is generated at each location. Okay, this is for hepatitis B, which is a DNA virus, hepatitis C being an RNA virus, and here, of course, due to again error proneness of the polymerase, you generate mutation, and this mutated genome is carried through, and actually, in case of hepatitis B, when the immune system is not working very properly, has not cleared the virus persists, and gives a chance for these quasi species to amplify under some host immune selection pressure. It could be immune pressure, it could be drug pressure, and then of course, so the case of resistance could be found in this. And here's an example, another of CMV virus, which is also a problem in this. So you can find resistance to these three drugs, which are popular drugs for this, and in virtually all in all three cases, the cause being the polymerase mutation, polymerase based mutations. Okay, those are the viruses. For bacteria, there are four important common reasons. Yeah, Michael. No, actually caused by DNA polymerase. Ganciclovir will be within the DNA polymerase itself. It's okay. Yes. The resistance. So DNA polymerase will cause an error everywhere, including its own genome. Yes. Yes. Actually, all three of them are targeting polymerase. Yes. Yes. Sometimes there are, I've not included some examples, that a mutation, another location, affects another location. So, which is, it's a very interesting case, and I don't have time to cover, but I'll cover another time this. So here, there are four common mechanisms of antibiotics. So I just briefly give you examples of some viral drug resistance. In case of bacterial, where antibiotics are a main source of treatment, there are four possible ways drug resistance develops. One, decrease permeability to cell. So this is a drug. It tries to get in, but not allowed. The second, the drug is modified enzymatically, and it's very common route, by the way. This third process is the target where this drug is supposed to bind, that itself is modified and mutated. Okay, so this is the third, and the fourth is it's already there, but it's also pumped out. So there's a whole system which gets it out of the cell. So these are four fundamental main sources of resistance development in bacteria. And you'll see here, for example, these all four processes can be affected by either mutation, and then from one bacterium to another, this resistance can be transferred by these three fundamental mechanism, which is viruses don't, one virus will not make another virus drug resistant. Bacteria will. So how they do, for example, transformation, when one bacterial cell is broken down, it has, and it is resistant, its genome can be transfected into a susceptible bug, and it will be incorporated into the genome of the susceptible bug, and it will become resistant. The other is through conjunctions. For example, a plasmid bearing a drug-resistant gene can be, by cell-cell contact, can be transferred to a resistant one. So it becomes resistant. The third is through transduction, through a retrovirus or some other virus, a bacteriophage may hijack a drug-resistant gene and then may infect a susceptible cell. So transfer of gene from resistant to susceptible bacterium is a very important part of bacterial drug resistance. And modeling, a lot of modeling is very, very helpful in this area, would be very helpful. This is an example. I'll go in very briefly, not much. Actually, the most dominant is this one. Yeah, most dominant. But so when you do the modeling, the degrees to which one matters becomes very important, the parameter values for you, right? And there are some good approximations of these events. This is only if the bacteriophage can be developed through that genome, which is not that common, okay? And of course, here is an example of antifungal. I just picked some example here and there. This was published in Nature last year. And what happens that, this is very interesting. You see, there is always evolutionary and immunological control race going on. So in this case, what happens, a drug which is supposed to be, antifungal drug, this happens to bind to, there is a special region of the transcription factor. These are transcription factor for a very interesting gene. This gene, PDRF5, this allows drug efflux. This drug happens to bind to a particular region, XBD, region of this transcription factor. And because of this binding, it allows association with this mediator complex. It's called mediator complex because it facilitates drug resistance. And once this is bound, it invites this polymerase and causes increased transcription of this protein. And this protein locates at the cell membrane. Consequently, when the drug is taken in, the drug facilitates is also an entry out. These mechanisms are very interesting and has tremendous implications in understanding of the evolutionary aspects of pathogen persistence and evolution. And of course, I will not even go into this. This is just to show you that in Leishmania also is a big problem. In other words, viral, bacterial, parasitic, malaria is some very nice papers came on malaria showing this problem. So this is just to give you an introduction on this. And here is a now, the other aspect of this, because this is happening in the context of pathogen replication. Pathogen replicates, then all these changes, genetic changes are allowed. But pathogen replication is happening in the context of immune response. It's also ongoing. So I thought I'll just introduce briefly, and of course, Bhargavi will take over from there, that these are four important components to immune response. It's pathogen detection and antigen processing, innate immune response, development of adaptive immune response, and establishment of immunological memory. I will try to cover some of that in more detail on Friday. Now, what happens, just I'll touch on this, pathogen detection and antigen processing, immune system, there are many cells in the immune system, dendritic cells, macrophages, and even B cells. They have what we call TLR, toll-like receptors. These are eyes and nose and ears of the immune system. They can see who is there at the door. For example, there are different TLRs which are linked to identifying double-strand RNA viruses, single-strand RNA viruses, and there is some duplication. bacterial pathogens and LPS bearing pathogens, gram positive, gram negative. So they can all distinguish that. Why I'm showing this slide is because depending on which TLR is recognizing pathogen, it triggers a particular set of patterns of cytokines, and I'll show you this another in more detail. And because of that, the nature of immune response differs. So it's not that so they are not all treated the same way. And you will see, based upon what cytokines and how this genome is treated by the signaling, you will have a very good T cell response and a very good B cell response. So and the consequences are very different in terms of taking care of pathogen, you know, replication, also in terms of mutations. So And here briefly, I just gave an example of, this is an old slide, example of a virus, because I'm not showing general pathogens, but for virus, innate immune response will be triggered differently as compared to some bacterial or fungal. So here's, let me take you through quickly through this. Here is a flu virus. I call it virus, but flu virus. We are working quite a bit on that, so it's always there. And Dr. Alexander and I have done lots of work in this area. He has some very extensive models in this area. So Marie Alexander will be giving a talk. So the flu virus, once it enters, it is, of course, it has two options, to attach to a target cell or to a what we call dendritic cell or macrophages, you know, wandering macrophages or dendritic cells, which I have grouped, called them as ones as APC, antigen-presenting cell, okay? And because there are much more target cells in the respiratory tract once the virus comes than the wandering, these dendritic cells and macrophages, the virus invariably has more probability of attaching to this, and it enters the cell, and it takes about a few hours before it becomes productive, the virus is being produced, okay? And then, so this infected cell will keep on producing virus. Once its sources are exhausted, it will be killed. And so also, this infected cell, which is not producing virus as yet, can also be a target of killing by activated NK cell. So there are two ways of killing. One, the virus will kill the infected cell because of rapid virus replication. Second, it will be killed by natural killer cells, okay? Because there's a third killing. So there are three important ways an infected cell can be killed, by virus itself, by natural killer cells, and by cytotoxic T cells, which I'll not talk about. Dr. Alexander is giving a very interesting talk on this how that matters. So and then once the virus replicates more and more, now it will be internalized, bind to the APCs, and either direct by phagocytosis or binding through TLR, doesn't matter, either way, it will be internalized, it is processed. Once it is processed, it now begins to express this process, the proteins of the virus are broken down. Some bind to MHC class 1, some bind to MHC class 2 and express on the cell surface, and this is antigen presenting cell that is now charged with the viral proteins and is ready to turn on the adaptive immune response. So the innate immunity has some byproducts. This is the most important byproduct of innate immunity: antigen-bearing, antigen-presenting cells, and then of course interferon gamma, interferon alpha and beta. All of these affect in ways which are mentioned here the adaptive immune response. And I'll leave this to Bhargava now. Okay. Do we shut this?
And show.
No. Okay. Yeah, here we are. Wait.
What are you doing?
Okay. Dr. Sai introduced us to you a little bit on immunity. I'll go into details, and it's a basic immunology. Okay. What is immunity? Immunity is a state of protection against an infection. That is an immunity. There are two types of immunities based on how we see and how we respond. Innate immunity is an immunity that is present before an infection. That is, it is something we are born with. And what is adaptive immunity? It's in the word itself, it's adaptive. It's a response that we develop to an infection. That is called as an adaptive immunity. So I'll cover in detail adaptive immunity. As I told you before, adaptive immunity is an immunity that an organism develops and adapts to recognize, eliminate, and remember the antigen, and specifically. So in brief, adaptive immune system is an antigen-specific defense mechanism. What is an antigen? Antigen is any foreign substance that can elicit an immune response. So I will cover what is the differences between innate and adaptive immunity. As I told you before, innate immunity is present before an infection is induced. And adaptive is something we develop after an infection. But these two are not independent. They are collaborative. They work together. So innate immunity is the first line of defense mechanism we have. So the response is immediate. As soon as we see the pathogen, it responds. Whereas in adaptive immunity, there is certain lag period, there is certain delay before a response is induced. Why? In the innate immunity, it's a pre-existing immune repertoire we have. So whatever toll-like receptors he mentioned, they're all there. They're genetically encoded. But it's not so in adaptive. Adaptive has to recognize an antigen, then it will synthesize the specific receptors. But adaptive immunity compensates for the slower response by being highly antigenic specific. For example, let's suppose we have, as you said, a DNA virus. It could be DNA virus A, it could be DNA virus B. Innate immunity, through toll-like receptor, it cannot differentiate between this A and B. But adaptive immunity can differentiate between this A DNA virus and B DNA virus. That is what is called being highly specific. Not only that, innate immunity is very limited because it's genetically encoded. But adaptive immunity is adaptive and it being highly diverse. And this diversity and specificity is achieved with the help of God. It's a suspense, I'll tell you who is God here, okay? And moreover, innate immunity does not have any memory. It cannot remember the antigen. Let's suppose you got this antigen X, and next time you get the antigen X again, it won't remember anything. But adaptive immunity will remember this antigen and will respond stronger. These are some of the hallmarks of innate and adaptive immunity. And of course, the whole basis of immunity is discriminating between a self, our own, and a foreign. That is the basis of immunity. And both innate and adaptive immunity have this self and non-self discrimination. And the major cells that mediate this adaptive immunity are T cells, B cells, and antigen-presenting cells. Let's see some of the players and their effector functions in the adaptive immunity. Adaptive immunity is again categorized into two. Humoral immunity, that will see the pathogen even before it enters the cell. Extracellular, outside the cell. That is by humoral immunity. On other hand, we have cell-mediated immunity. Because some of the pathogens can escape this humoral immunity and can enter the cell. For example, viruses. They are intracellular parasites. So in such case, the immunity is by cell-mediated immunity. They detect intracellular pathogens, inside the cell. Coming to the humoral immunity, it's also called an antibody-mediated immunity. Why? because the antigenic recognition is by an antibody. So what you see here, these are antibodies. These are antibodies. The Y-shaped molecules are the antibodies. And these antibodies are both membrane bound. For example, you see on this B cell, it is bound to this, or soluble. And these are synthesized by B cells. They are white blood cells that develop in a bone marrow. One of the hallmarks of this humoral immunity is that the antibodies can recognize a free antigen. For example, if you see here, it's a whole antigen. An antibody can recognize a whole antigen and a free antigen on its own. It does not need any help. You will know the difference once I talk about the T cells. Now, B cells, upon recognition of this antigen, they will get activated, they will get various signals, and with the help from T cells, they differentiate into plasma cells that will secrete the antibodies. So the major players of the humoral immunity are the antibodies. But we need a protection from reinfections, and that's why the B cells also differentiate into memory B cells. This will respond whenever we get a second encounter with the same antigen. And I repeat again, humoral immunity will detect and prevent the entry of extracellular pathogens. It's a prominent domain for extracellular pathogens. And here's the structure of an antibody. It's a Y-shaped molecule. It has a heavy chain, shown in blue here, and it has a light chain. The region where this heavy chain and light chain interacts form a variable region. And it is to this region the antigen will bind. It's a bivalent. It can bind two antigens at the same time. And this region is called a constant region on the heavy chain. And it is this region which is responsible for the function of an antibody. For example, whenever we talk about virus, we say neutralization of virus. What does it mean? That is mediated by this N, complement activation, the main soluble factors of innate immunity, or agglutination, clumping of the pathogens. All these effector functions are mediated by this end. And based on this heavy chain, there are five different types of antibodies. I call them GAMDE. They are here. And each have its own unique function. And here is a schematic that shows how antibodies are produced. So once a B cell binds to a pathogen, it will internalize it and it will degrade it. And this degraded pathogen is presented on the B cell in the context of a protein called MHC class II. It is a cell surface membrane. So you have a processed antigen, only a fragment of antigen bound to this MHC class II molecule. Now T helper 2 cells, they will recognize this processed antigen that is bound to MHC class II. They in turn will get activated. They will secrete cytokines, a soluble factor, that will activate B cell to undergo proliferation, to increase in the number, because we need more and more antibodies now. And not only that, they will differentiate into plasma cells that will secrete the antibodies. And that will further eliminate the pathogen. So as I told you before, what happens when once the pathogen invades the cell? We need a protection. Then antibody cannot protect us. That's why we have a cell-mediated immunity. It involves a specialized cells called as T cells. So unlike B cells that have membrane-bound antibodies and also soluble antibodies, T cells only have membrane-bound receptors. They're called as T cell receptors. And these T cells are classified into two main types: T helper cells that carry CD4 protein on their cell surface. And these T helper cells are called as brains of immune system because they stimulate all other immune cells. And another major type of T cell is cytotoxic T cell, which carry CD8 molecule on its surface. And they are the major effectors of cell-mediated immunity because they basically kill any intracellularly infected cell, for example, virus-infected cell or any tumor cell. Unlike B cells, which can recognize a whole antigen, a free antigen on their own, T cells cannot recognize a whole antigen. They will recognize only a processed antigen. That means only a part of antigen that is bound to this MHC molecule called major histocompatibility complex. And this is the schematic that shows you the antigen presentation to T cell in the context of MHC. Why is this MHC so important? There are two types of MHC molecules based on to which cell they present the antigen. Class 1 MHC molecules present antigen to CD8 T cells, and they are expressed mostly on all cells. And any cell that expresses this MHC class 1, it is called as a target cell. Why? Because if you have cell A that is infected with the virus, and you want your immune system to recognize that it is infected by a virus, what happens is the virus protein is processed and is expressed in the context of MHC class 1 on its cell. And immediately the CD8 T cell will differentiate into cytotoxic T lymphocyte and will kill it. On other hand, class 2 MHC molecules, they present the antigen to the CD4 T cells or T helper cells, which are the brains of immune system. Unlike MHC class 1, they are expressed only on antigen presenting cells such as dendritic cells, macrophages, and B cells. And that's why MHC class 1 presents only the endogenous antigens, whatever antigens that are produced within a cell, for example, virus infected cell. And even the size of the peptide that is being processed is also very small. On the other hand, class 2 MHC molecules present exogenous antigen. For example, any antigen that is floating around is internalized, is processed, and again presented. And this is about the MHC restriction. In order to make sure that our body differentiates between what is self and what is non-self. Antigen presenting cells. These are the main cells that will link the innate arm, which is a non-specific arm, and the highly specific arm, which is adaptive. As I told you before, APCs are dendritic cells, macrophages, and B lymphocytes. Here is the APC, or antigen presenting cell. So it will present a processed antigen, shown here in a green bar, to a T cell receptor that is present on CD4 T cell. So this will give a signal 1 for a T helper cell to get activated. But it needs a signal 2 to fully get activated. That signal 2 is provided by a co-stimulation. So this presentation of an antigen by these dendritic cells, macrophages, and B lymphocytes is very crucial for the regulation of an immune system. Not only the antigen-presenting cells, there are certain soluble protein factors that are secreted whenever an immune cell is activated, and they are called cytokines. As I told you before, T helper cells are the brains of an immune system. But how do they talk with other immune cells? It is through this cytokine secretion. Here is a schematic that shows you how T helper cells can activate other immune cells. For example, an activated T helper cell can secrete interleukin 2, 4, or 5 and can activate a B cell. That means a cell-mediated arm is activating a humoral arm of the immune system. On the other hand, if you see here, an activated T helper cell can secrete an interferon gamma and can activate a macrophage, which is a cell from innate arm. That means both innate and adaptive are talking here. Macrophages, in turn, can secrete interleukin 12 that will activate T helper cell. And this figure shows you how interactive the immune system is. Both arms of the immune system, they collaborate with each other to come out with a function that either cannot achieve independently. And antigen recognition by T cells. You know this already. So whenever a cell is infected by a virus, the antigen is processed and presented in the context of MHC class 1 to cytotoxic T cell. This will directly kill that virus-infected cell, such as here. Apoptotic means a cell that has undergone a cell death. On the other hand, T helper 1 cell, once it is activated by a macrophage in the context of MHC class 2, it will secrete certain cytokines that will activate this macrophage. This macrophage will in turn kill that bacteria. It is highly activated state of the macrophage whenever T helper cell secretes the cytokines. On other hand, whenever a T helper 2 recognizes an antigen in the context of MHC class 2 on B cell, it will activate the B cell to secrete an antibodies. Remember, antibodies are the major effectors of the humoral immunity. So these antibodies will now eliminate the pathogen. Not only this, the B cell will also differentiate into memory B cell. Okay, so far we have seen the players and the effective functions of an adaptive immune system. What is innate arm? What is adaptive arm? What is humoral? What is cell mediated? Let us now see the main characteristics of adaptive immune system. Why is it highly specific, highly diverse? Why is the memory so? And why is this self-non-self discrimination, which is the basis for immunity? Antigenic specificity of an immune adaptive immune system is possible because each B cell here, whatever B cell you are seeing here, they express single specific receptor, which is nothing but an antibody. That means each B cell will express hundreds of an antibody, but all will recognize a same antigen. That means each lymphocyte is monospecific. So what happens is, whenever an antigen, for example, shown here in red, enters into your body, though there are several B cells present here, it will activate only this specific B cell that can recognize this red. So a red antibody here will recognize a red antigen. The red, the color code means the specificity of the antibody to the antigen. That means, so once this antibody will recognize this antigen, it will expand, it will undergo a clonal expansion to form many, many, many antibodies. And that's how the antigenic specificity is achieved. I repeat again, each lymphocyte will bear a receptor that will recognize a single antigen. And that monospecificity is the basis for the high specificity of adaptive immune system. Highly diverse. We all know that human genome encodes for around 30,000 proteins. But if you see on daily basis, we are exposed to unlimited number of antigens, many, many, many antigens. But we are all healthy, we are all fine. That means our immune system is acting, is very effective. But how is this possible? To face a billions and billions of antigens with such a limited repertoire of 30,000 proteins, this is achieved with the help of God. Who is God here? In the immune system, God means generation of diversity. Though we have a limited number of proteins, those limited number of proteins are diversified through these mechanisms. I cannot go into details of each of these mechanisms, but I can give you a teaser. So as I told you before, each antibody molecule is made up of a heavy chain and light chain, and heavy chain and light chain, they interact to form an antigen binding region and all that. This heavy chain variable region is in turn formed by this V variable D diversity J joining segments. So like, let's suppose we have one V, one D, and one J. That means we can only synthesize only one type of an antibody. That's not enough. So what happened is, we have a multiple genes for this V, D, and J. And you're all mathematicians, you know. The possible number of combinations we get when these gene segments, when they combine, is huge. Not only that, once a VDJ is formed for heavy chain, a VJ is formed for light chain, they also have a combinatorial joining that in turn increases the diversity. And with all these mechanisms listed here, the possible number of immune receptors we can generate is around 10 to the power of 12. So now there is no correlation between 30,000 what we talked about and what we have now. This is what God has done to immune system. As I told you before, the basis for the immunity is to discriminate between the self, our own, and the foreign, which is non-self. How is this achieved? For example, here is a precursor molecule or a stem cell that will give rise to various lymphocytes. Initially, this stem cell will give rise to an immature lymphocyte, and they have a receptors on their surface which can be antibodies here. And this is all taking place in the bone marrow, that is the site of development for the lymphocytes. Let's suppose any of these lymphocytes and their receptors recognize a self component, a self protein, they are not allowed to develop further. They will be killed. And only those lymphocytes that can see the foreign, or at least not the self, they will be allowed to develop or allowed to mature. And finally, they reach the periphery. So it is this clonal deletion of any lymphocytes with the receptors that can see the self is the basis for self and non-self discrimination. However, this is not perfect. And whenever this is not perfect, it leads to an autoimmunity. And one of the hallmarks of adaptive immune system, apart from all these, is immunologic memory. The ability to remember an antigen and mount an improved response with a second encounter with the same antigen is a memory. It's an immunologic memory which is mediated by a memory B cells or memory T cells. And how does this happen? So what you see here on the graph, on the y-axis is the antibody level, and on the x-axis is the time in days. So when you introduce an antigen A, so upon first exposure to an antigen A, being a typical adaptive immune system, there is certain lag before the antibody levels reach to peak. And this lag period is very dynamic. What is happening in this lag period? Whatever naive B cells or naive lymphocytes that were allowed to come through the bone marrow and reach the periphery, they will now recognize this antigen. They will clonally proliferate to form many, many plasma cells that will secrete the antibodies. And not only that, they will also secrete a memory cell for future remembrance. So once an antibody level raises to peak, the pathogen is eliminated in most of the cases. And since you don't want any non-specific inflammatory responses, the level again comes down to homeostatic state level. Now when you introduce a second time the same antigen A, you will see a heightened response, and there is not much lag period here. It was around 5 to 7 days here. It will be around 1 to 3 days at most. How is this possible? You know, in the primary response, there was a lag. And if you see the immune response, it was not at the peak, you know, the maximum response as you see here. How is this possible? Because during the primary immune response, the memory cells are already formed. And if you see the number, they are huge. So this pre-existing memory cells is the reason why during a second encounter with the same antigen, you see a quicker response, a rapid response. And why is it high? You see the number. They are huge now. As soon as they see the antigen, they will proliferate into many, many immune cells. This graph also tells you one important thing about the specificity. See, at the same point, I have introduced antigen A and antigen B, but you are seeing the secondary response only for antigen A, but not for antigen B. That means whatever memory cells that are formed, they're highly specific for antigen A. This is the antigenic specificity of adaptive immune system. So in summary of what are different phases we have in adaptive immune system. So the first phase is recognition. Naive T and naive B means they have never seen any antigen before. They are innocent. They are called as naive. So once this naive T lymphocytes and naive B lymphocytes, they recognize the antigen in their own context. They undergo clonal expansion, and they differentiate into effectors, for example, plasma cells secreting antibodies or cytotoxic T cells. In the effector phase, they will eliminate the antigens. And once that elimination is done, and once the pathogen is cleared, they'll come back to normal level. However, a memory is still there for future encounter. Here are the different phases of the adaptive immune system. And here is a summary, like how innate and adaptive collaborate to protect the body. Dendritic cells are from the innate arm. They are antigen-presenting cells. They present the antigen to the adaptive arm, and they present antigen to T helper cells. The T helper cells are the brains of the immune system. So upon recognition of antigen, they get activated. Once they get activated, they will also activate naive B cells. Not only that, they will also activate macrophages here, which in turn activate the T helper cells. So like it's like they're talking to each other. The crosstalk between innate and adaptive is very dynamic once the pathogen enters into the host. So the final conclusion is adaptive immune system is highly specific, highly diverse, and has a memory, and it has a self-non-self discrimination. And having said this, both innate and adaptive are required for the efficient immune response. They are interdependent on each other. Thank you very much. I thank you all for all attention, and Dr. Jane Heffernan for this opportunity. Oh, sorry.